All right, it's about time for us to turn this microphone down. About time for us to get started here. And we are continuing on in our study of Jonah, setting aside the 1 Corinthians study that Tom's doing on Sunday since he's out of town. And I don't want to try to jump into the middle of his class and continue that on, so I'll continue my class from Wednesday night. We'll cover this over the next few classes together. We talked about Jonah 1 almost all of it last time, but as I said, this is one of those classic bad chapter divisions in the Bible, where verse 17 of chapter 1 goes much better with chapter 2, and in fact, in the Hebrew text, it is the beginning of chapter 2. I'm not sure what happened in the transition from Hebrew to English, but somehow we got with chapter 2, 1 in the wrong spot. And the reason I say that is because the prayer is the bulk of chapter 2, and it is framed with verse 17 of chapter 1 and verse 10 of chapter 2. The Lord appointed a great fish to swallow up Jonah, and the Lord spoke to the fish, and it vomited Jonah upon the dry land. And so the prayer is framed by God's actions regarding this fish. So that's pretty clearly a single unit of thought. This chapter, I would suggest to you, is simultaneously the best known and the least known part of the book of Jonah, which is an odd combination of things. It's the best known because it's what we think about the most when we think about Jonah, is Jonah in the fish. If I said, and I think I said this a few classes ago at the beginning, if I said, Jonah, what's the first thing you think about? You think about the fish. He was in that fish for 3 days and three nights. And there's a reason that we do come to that. I mean, Jesus even emphasizes that when he talks about the sign of Jonah in the New Testament. And we'll talk briefly about that even today. But it is probably overstated in terms of its significance to the story. We think of Jonah in the fish. We have sometimes images of our own creation of what it would have been like for Jonah to be in the fish. We argue about what kind of fish it might have been. We argue about whether it was a fish or a sea mammal. We come up with all sorts of things to talk about this fish. But the reality is the fish takes up a whopping two verses of the entire story. Now, I mean, it's implicit in this prayer, but it is mentioned twice in the entire book. At the beginning, when it swallows Jonah, and at the end, when it spits him back out. The reality is we don't know anything about what the fish was like, what the journey was like, what Jonah's quarters were like, how he felt in the midst of it beyond what he says in his prayer. We know virtually nothing about that at all, although it is what we tend to think about the most when we think about the book of Jonah. And so it's what we know the most, at least kind of in our own imaginations, about the book of Jonah. But it is actually so little and minimal to the story that we've made it far, far more than it actually is. And what we can know about that is very small. That's one reason why I say it's the least of what we know in the book, because there's just so much we can't possibly know about that. And then secondly, it's a lesser known part of the book because when we think about the story of Jonah, if we're not thinking about the fish, we're thinking about Jonah running and Jonah preaching and Jonah complaining, which is chapters 1, 3, and 4. And we don't typically, at least in my experience, spend a lot of time talking about Jonah praying. This is the chapter that kind of gets skipped. The rest of it's the story, and the story is the fun part because it's a story. I mean, that's what you like, are stories. And so it's easy to skip past chapter 2 or read through it, you know, not completely skip it, but you read through it and move on beyond that. So this is a chapter that is an important one in the transformation of Jonah, but I'm not quite sure how much he's transforming in the final analysis. It is the transformation of Jonah from someone who will not do what God tells him to do to someone who grudgingly does what God tells him to do. Beyond that, we don't know what Jonah's transformation is like. The book ends off with Jonah complaining and God lecturing him about it, and we don't know where it goes after that. But it is at least something of a transformation because it allows Jonah to go do what he had been told to do to begin with. So that's kind of a background and introduction to this chapter. Is there any loose ends or anything from chapter 1 or about anything that I said there by way of introduction anyone wants to comment on, weigh in on, argue against? All right, well, before we get into the text itself, let's begin with a prayer. Our good Father, we're so thankful to you that you're merciful to us in spite of our constant failing of what you would have us to do. Help us to humble ourselves before it takes drastic measures, that we would obey you, and help us to do so with a willing and joyful spirit, thrilled to be called your servants and to do your work in this world. Help us as we study to be humble before your word and let it shape us into what you would have us to be. In your Son we pray. Amen. All right, so let's begin then with that framing of this story or this prayer itself. Like I say, it's framed by the narrative, which is in verse 17, the Lord appointed a great fish to swallow up Jonah, and Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and three nights. And then in verse 10, after the prayer, the Lord spoke to the fish, and it vomited Jonah out upon the dry land. And so this is a journey that Jonah is taking. He begins the journey by getting in the boat and going out upon the sea. And when we left him, he had been thrown into the sea. And that's where he is when the fish swallows him. And of course, it makes its journey. And we know, like I say, we know nothing about what that journey was like, where it began, where the fish spat Jonah back up. But it is a journey from the sea back to the dry land. From verse 17 of chapter 1 to verse 10 of chapter 2. And it is action that's initiated by God. This is something that we've seen constantly in the very beginning of the book. The word of the Lord came to Jonah and said, "Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city." And so it begins with God saying, this is what's going to happen. The action is initiated by God. And Jonah runs. He gets in the ship, he's heading off to Tarshish, verse 4. But the Lord hurled a great wind upon the sea, and there was a mighty tempest upon the sea, so the ship threatened to break up. And so again, the action is initiated by God. In verse 17, the Lord appointed a great fish to swallow up Jonah. Chapter 3 and verse 1, the word of the Lord again came to Jonah the second time, saying, "Arise and go to Nineveh, that great city." And then down in chapter 4 and verse 6, the Lord God appointed a plant and made it come up over his head. And then the Lord appointed the worm, and it came and attacked the plant. And so God is the initiator all the way through the book of Jonah. This is just one of the times that happens, but it's an important thing to realize that Jonah is constantly working against God or working with God one way or the other. Sometimes he seems to be ignorant of what God is doing, but God is the one who is most actively doing in the story of the book of Jonah, and it is in the realm controlled by God. It is in the sea that this is happening, and you got the glimpse of this back in chapter 1 and verse 9, when the storm is on the sea and the ship is threatening to break up, and they find Jonah asleep and say, "Cry out to your God. What's the matter with you, man?" And that's, like we said last time, it's the best and the worst news that the ship's captain could possibly have. The best news because he has actually found the person whose God can solve this problem. The bad news is, this guy's on really, really bad terms with God. He's run away from him and rejected him, and that's why all this has happened. So, whatever the case may be, the lot falls on Jonah to let them know that either he's the one who knows what's going on, or he is the one who is the cause of what's going on, and they give him this, blasting of questions. And he says in response, "I am a Hebrew," this is verse 9 of chapter 1, "I'm a Hebrew, and I fear Yahweh, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land." And the significance of that statement, "he made the sea and the dry land," is that he is sovereign over the sea and the dry land. He is in control of the sea and the dry land. There's nothing that is outside of his reach. And so when Jonah is thrown into the sea, he is thrown into another realm that is controlled by God. And as he sinks to his demise, God pursues him as vigorously under the sea as he did above the sea. And he appoints this great fish to swallow Jonah up. And as we talked about in our introductory class, the point of this is not to make, marine biological sorts of distinctions. about what kind of fish it was, or even whether it was, you know, a fish or a giant sea mammal. Those are not the kinds of distinctions they cared about making. It's beyond the capability of what this word, this Hebrew word, does. That's not the point. And we get too hung up on that far too frequently. Also, we get too hung up on trying to figure out what kind of fish it could have been that Jonah could have survived in. I've heard way too many people arguing about that. Well, this sort of fish, it's large enough, they could have swallowed them. Okay. This sort of fish has a low enough stomach acidic content that... None of that is the point. This is obviously a miraculous story. That's the point. God is doing something that is beyond normal. I mean, we don't look at Jesus' miracles and say, now, what kind of lake could he have walked across? That's not the point. What kind of bread could he have kept breaking that would have multiplied over and over and over to feed five? No, it's a miracle. That's what it is. And the same thing is true here. And likewise, the implausibility is beside the point. The fact that someone could get swallowed by a fish and survive for 3 days and get spat out and be alive, people have a hard time with that. And there are people that reject the entirety of the book of Jonah because this is impossible. Well, of course it's impossible. That's sort of what makes miracles impressive, is that they're not normal. I mean, if people went walking around on tops of lakes all the time, it wouldn't be that impressive when Jesus did it. If people came back from the dead all the time, it wouldn't have been that impressive when Jesus did it. The whole thing about the miraculous is that it is supernatural. It is above nature. And so, you know, unless you are philosophically predisposed to not believe in the miraculous, whether or not this could have happened according to natural laws is beside the point. There's a God who can create the universe. There is a God who can create a fish that can swallow Jonah and he can live inside it. So, I mean, if you are believing in miracles, there's no reason to reject Jonah, the story, because of the miracle. And I don't presume that that's a problem here, but it's an absurdity that is out there that you will certainly run into. Charlie? Linguistically, I don't know if there's anything strikingly different in the one or the other. I would have to look into that. Is one of these a saying that is specific? I mean, looking at it, I think you're right. Looking at it in English, it looks like that's much of a more direct sort of discourse, and it seems more indirect. The word of the Lord came to Jonah. There may be some difference in one of them being kind of a standard way that the word of God coming to a prophet is that's the normal way that that's described, and so that's why it's described that way for Jonah. I don't know offhand, but you're right. It does look that way, at least, that this is distinguished from how God speaks to Jonah. If there's a grand significance of that, I'll have to think about that some more. It may, like you say, it may just be simply because he's talking to a fish instead of talking to a person. Well, he was in the belly of the fish 3 days and three nights, we're told there back in verse 17 as well. There's an interesting thing in the original context, the original cultural context, that's worth noting, and how much to make of this in the context of Jonah is a debatable point. But it's at least worth noting that in a variety of ancient pagan mythologies, they believed that it would take 3 days and three nights to travel from this life to the underworld, to the realm of the dead. And that probably is part of what's wrapped up in the idea, even in Jewish culture, that the fourth day is the day the soul leaves the body, which is tied up in that being the day that physical decay becomes noticeable as well. And so there's a lot of this tied up together in a variety of cultures. And so for him, you know, he's begun this journey to death by being thrown off the ship. And he'll, you know, go so far as to say, you know, out of the belly of Sheol I cried there in verse 1. He says he is descending to death. And there may be something of a symbolic way of saying that this journey is a journey that he is taking to death, but then God rescues him out of that, which would then, I think, strengthen even the connection to the sign of Jonah. It's a journey to Sheol that ends in life instead of death. And that is, obviously, in a Christian context, what we think of when we think of the sign of Jonah, that Jesus says, the sign of Jonah, as Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and three nights, so I'll be in the belly of the earth, and I'll rise again. So the resurrection is clearly the primary point of that. But another interesting thought that, again, I don't want to press too far, because it's obvious that what Jesus is talking about is the resurrection itself. But what's interesting to think about in a different context is if you expand the idea from just the resurrection to the resurrection and all of its implications. And the reason I say that is when you look at Jonah's story, his descent into Sheol begins when he sacrifices himself to save these sailors. And so you've got a self-sacrifice at the beginning of this. And with that, in verse 14, "You, O Lord, have done as it pleased you, the sailors say." Or we might paraphrase, "Your will was done." Chapter 2 and verse 9, "Salvation belongs to the Lord." Salvation is the ultimate result that Jonah sees in all of this. It's going to lead in chapter 3 to Jonah preaching repentance that leads to widespread Gentile conversion of some kind. And ultimately, the success of Jonah's mission leads to the deliverance of the Gentiles. And that ultimately leads to the destruction of the nation of Israel. Because if Assyria had been destroyed by God, Assyria would not have been destroying Samaria a little while later. And so you bring that back to the context of Jesus, and you've got self-sacrifice, you've got God's will being done, you've got salvation belonging to the Lord, you've got the preaching of repentance and widespread Gentile conversion, you've got the deliverance of the Gentiles, and ultimately the destruction of the Jews because they rejected the Messiah. So you've got a variety of different kinds of connections wrapped up between Jonah and what goes on here and Jesus and what he's doing. So while certainly primarily the sign of Jonah that Jesus is speaking of is the resurrection, it's at least suggestive to think about it beyond that and think about it. And I mean, if nothing else, you've got sort of general typological sort of ideas here. Dan? That's a good question. I've heard people talk about it from that perspective, that maybe the real sign is not that he was alive and it was like he was buried, but that he did actually in fact die and God did raise him from the dead. So there is that possibility in thinking about Jonah and the fish as well. Stephen?
Assume that it being here as one fish is like in some way a very intentional choice, and at least like God, to just make it happen this way. I don't know what that is, but there's something very significant about what miracle is it that only Jesus ever does? Is it healing
of a man born blind?
Yeah. No one ever does that, and it maintains how special it is that he was raised from the dead, given this has only happened twice.
What, the resurrection?
From the dead?
Well, in the Old Testament, it doesn't happen. It happens a couple of other times. Does Elisha raise someone as well? And then there's the guy that gets chucked into Elisha's grave. They're burying someone, and a raiding party comes, and they're like, get rid of this guy, and they toss him, and he hits Elisha's bones and pops back to life, which is simultaneously cool and terrifying. There's a few, but it is very infrequent, like you say. Lee, were you going to say something?
I'll get with you
after. Okay. So that's Jonah in the sea. Verse 10, like I say, moves him to the dry land. So he moves from the realm that is controlled by God to the realm that is controlled by God, which again is sort of one of the main points of the story of Jonah, is that you can't get out of God's control. You can't run away from Him. You can't jump in the sea to get away from Him. You can't hide in a fish to get away from Him. You're not getting away from Him. And so when you get brought back to the dry land and He tells you to do something, then you need to do what He says. And it's an interesting thing. He vomits Jonah back out on the dry land. The last time dry land comes up in the story is when Jonah says in chapter 1, "Pick me up and hurl me into the sea, that the sea may quiet down for you. For I know it's because of me this great tempest has come upon you. Nevertheless, the men rowed hard to get back to the dry land, but they could not." Remember, they wanted to deposit Jonah on the dry land because they didn't want Jonah's blood on their hands. And so with all their might, the entire crew strives to get Jonah to this place, and they cannot do so. And God just says a word and it happens. And again, the contrast between God's power and human power can't be any more manifest in all of this. Now, one last thing that I'll say by way of kind of introduction to the prayer itself in chapter 2, and this is not a major sort of point, but it is worth noting, as some of the language here is related to this. The ancients did not have the same conception of the world as the moderns do. And different people's concept of the world has changed drastically over the years in different ways. But basically, the ancients thought of the world as being three-storied, that there were the heavens that were above the earth, and that the earth was in the middle, and Sheol, the place of the dead, was underneath the earth. And there were also subterranean waters, the deep, as it was called, a very terrifying idea. But the earth floated on these subterranean waters, and it was anchored by pillars or mountains, the feet of the mountains, into whatever was beneath the deep, I guess. And then ultimately, below those waters was Sheol, the realm of the dead. And so the idea of being thrown from the sea, which itself was a terrifying thing in the ancient world, the sea was frequently identified with a god. There were sea gods, of course, as well. So the sea itself was frequently deified. It was a terrifying thing, but as you're thrown in, you are, in their conception, their cosmological conception of the universe, when you're thrown in, you are heading straight toward the realm of the dead. And so that's, I think, a part of that background is important for some of this prayer itself. All right, anything about this before we move on to the prayer, verses 1 through 9? All right, so this is actually a psalm of thanksgiving. It's a prayer, of course, but what it looks like in every way imaginable are psalms of thanksgiving that you find in the book of Psalms. Now, the categories of psalms, psalms of trust, psalms of thanksgiving, royal psalms, laments, psalms of praise, all of those different categories of psalms, those are descriptive categories, not prescriptive categories. Now, what that means, if you're not familiar with that kind of terminology about something like this, is there was a prescriptive psalm would be, here's your list of what you need to include to write this kind of psalm. And you say, oh, okay, I'm going to write that kind of psalm. And then you go write it. You have been prescribed what makes that psalm up. There were not lists like that in the ancient world as far as we know. David didn't say, I'm going to write a psalm of trust today. Let me check the list. Okay, I need an appeal to God. I need a difficult situation. I need to express, he's just writing a psalm. And so they're not prescriptive in the sense that there was some formula that they were following. They're descriptive in the sense that scholars over the years, since they were written, have studied them intently and noticed, hey, all these psalms share these elements, and all these psalms share these elements, and all these psalms share these elements. And so they kind of get grouped together by the similarities they have. And so psalms of thanksgiving typically focus on a time of distress and a time of deliverance, and the psalmist praising God for that deliverance and making a promise to God of some kind. And not all of them are identical, not all of them focus on all those elements the same way, but what has been noticed is there are a group of psalms that share those four basic traits: distress, deliverance, praise, and promise, and those are called psalms of thanksgiving. And that's what this prayer looks like as well. And so that raises an interesting question of whether this is an original composition of Jonah, that he prayed this for the very first time these words were ever uttered, or whether there was a psalm that he knew that he sung in a moment of trial. Now, this is not in the book of Psalms, so it's not something from there, but not everything that was ever sung in Israel is in the book of Psalms either. And some people chafe at the notion of the Bible having something that's a possible quotation of some other song. What I would say is we know there are places where the Bible quotes other things. Paul quotes other things. He quotes Greek philosophers. So the idea of quoting something else isn't outside the context of the Bible. And it also is very realistic because I don't know about you, but I have found myself at times of difficulty singing Be With Me, Lord, or something like that, because that was easier than coming up with something all on my own, and it said everything that I needed to say. So we don't know exactly what the case is. There certainly are phrases in this that could have come directly out of a variety of the psalms in the book of Psalms. Perhaps it's an original prayer, but it's just very strongly informed by what he knew from these other sorts of contexts. What's most important, though, probably to notice about this is that God's name is featured three times in this psalm. In verse 2, right at the beginning, I called out to the Lord, Yahweh, there in all caps, Lord is Yahweh. I called out to the Lord out of my distress, and he answered me. And then in the middle, in verses 5 and 6, verse 6 ends with, Yet you brought up my life from the pit, O Lord my God. And then finally, the very last line of this psalm, salvation belongs to the Lord. So I called out to the Lord, you brought my life up from the pit, O Lord, salvation belongs to the Lord. So the story of Jonah follows again upon the actions of God here. And he recognizes that even here in the belly of the fish, in the depths of the sea, he is not outside of the realm of God. He recognizes that God is the decisive player in the transformation from his trouble to his restoration, from the pit that he is in back to the temple that he wants to be at. And so this is, our best clue that Jonah is alive at least at some point in all of this to pray this prayer. Does that mean that he's alive the entire time in the belly of the fish? That's a separate question. But, there is life in him to utter this prayer at some point in the midst of it. So let's take the time to read through this. Then we'll have some more comments about it as far as it goes. So Jonah chapter 2. Then Jonah prayed to the Lord his God from the belly of the fish, saying, I called out to the Lord out of my distress, and he answered me. Out of the belly of Sheol I cried, and you heard my voice. For you cast me into the deep, into the heart of the seas, and the flood surrounded me. All your waves and your billows passed over me. Then I said, I am driven away from your sight, yet I shall look again upon your holy temple. The waters closed in over me to take my life. The deep surrounded me. Weeds were wrapped about my head at the roots of the mountains. I went down to the land whose bars closed upon me forever. Yet you brought up my life from the pit, O Lord my God. When my life was fainting away, I remembered the Lord, and my prayer came to you into your holy temple. Those who pay regard to vain idols forsake their hope of steadfast love. But I, with a voice of thanksgiving, will sacrifice to you what I have vowed to pay. Salvation belongs to the Lord. And the Lord spoke to the fish, and it vomited Jonah out upon the dry land. All right, so two parts to this, really. First of all, there is the report of his distress in verses 2 through 7, and then there is the praise and promise. And so the distress and deliverance at the outset, the praise and the promise there at the end. And again, that's your basic sort of structure of one of these particular psalms. So again, he does acknowledge that God is the chief actor in this drama of his life. We said that by, focusing on God being the initiator of action in a variety of places in the story. But Jonah notices this in particular as it relates to his current situation. Notice in verse Well, in verse 2, I called out to the Lord, He answered me. Out of the belly of Sheol I cried, You heard my voice. And so there is that recognizing that God is there and God is hearing. But even as it leads up to where He is now, you cast me into the deep. Not the sailors cast me into the deep. Not that I told them to cast me into the deep. God cast him into the deep. Not because God is the one who actually did the action itself, but God created the situation in which this was the only possible way forward. It is God's action that led to Jonah being cast in. You cast me into the deep, into the heart of the seas, and the floods surrounded me. All your waves and your billows passed over me. And so he is the God who is in control of this storm. You know, there are some pretty significant implications of this. You know, if you've got people who are conspiring against you, you have hope of overcoming them. When God is conspiring against you, no one's going to save you except for changing God's perspective on you at that moment. You know, if somebody is trying to bury you under a pile of work, if someone is trying to bury you under a mountain of stress, if someone is trying to bury you in the ground, you have hope of getting out of it. But when you are being buried by divine design, there is no escape by human means. And here, Jonah was cast into the sea by God, and he was under God's waves and God's billows, which means there is nothing that Jonah can do to rectify his situation on his own. And so he understands, you know, he is calling out of the belly of Sheol. It is death that is before him. And Sheol here, if you're not familiar with that idea, it's a word, it has something of a range of meaning, as most words do. There are some places where it means nothing but the literal grave. You put the body in the ground. That is perhaps a minority of times. Unfortunately, the NIV, as a translation, decided that they're going to translate Sheol with grave all the way through the Old Testament, which is, I think, a poor choice because it doesn't mean just that. Here, especially, it doesn't mean that because there is no literal grave that Jonah is talking about. But it means grave on some level. But it also comes to mean, especially in other mythologies, the realm of the dead, the underworld, the place where the departed will go. And there is a variety of interesting thoughts and questions about that concept and what they thought about that concept. But then also it can come to mean, by extension, just the idea of death. The concept of death itself. And so anytime you see this word, in most translations, probably these days, we'll just transliterate it. Sheol is just the Hebrew word Sheol, but you get it in English letters instead of Hebrew letters. And so it's transliterated into English. And it's because what exactly is the implication of this word in this instance? And if you pick one specific one, then it rules out the others, and you know, who knows if that's exactly what it means or if everyone's going to agree on that. So Sheol is the realm of the dead, probably here is the idea, or perhaps death. But notice that he's not afraid of the grave, and I don't think he's just afraid of death itself. As this goes on, I'm driven away, verse 4, I'm driven away from your sight. That's his concern. His concern is the loss of relationship, that he has been abandoned by God. He's being separated from God. He's being left in this realm of the dead apart from God, seems to be his bigger fear. And so here I think Sheol is not just the idea of death, and certainly not literally a plot in the ground where his body's going to lie, but this place of the dead where he feels like he'll be separated from God. But instead, you heard me out of the belly of Sheol. So far from being abandoned by God, there God hears him even from there and responds to him. He's surrounded by the sea. In verse 5 in particular, the waters closed in over me to take my life. The deep surrounded me. Weeds were wrapped around my head. So he is a prisoner in the sea. He is surrounded by it on every side, enclosed in every way, and he's tied up. He's bound by the seaweed itself, which is also conspiring against him, he says. Sinking to the very bottom of it, at the roots of the mountains I went down. The very base of the mountain at the bottom of the ocean is where he will find himself. And again, that is in this, you know, ancient cosmology, even beneath the continental surface, the earth is sitting in these waters, and it is the roots of the mountains that go below them and anchor the ground in. So he's sinking beneath the earth, which is, again, taking him to the realm of the dead in their way of thinking. So everything is going down, going down. And you remember we talked about that, right? That's this major theme in chapter 1. God says, go to Nineveh. But instead, he went and went down to Joppa. And he found a ship and went down into the ship. And then he went down into the inner parts of the ship where he's fallen asleep. And now here in verse 6, I went down to the land whose bars close upon me forever. Yet you brought up my life from the pit. And so all of that downward direction that begins at the very outset of this story is finally being reversed and turned around. And it really has nothing to do with Jonah and everything to do with God. I mean, he says his prayer. He is as hopeful, I'm sure, as much as you possibly can be as you're sinking to your death. You can be hopeful. But it is God's gracious mercy that reaches down to Jonah. And it is when he can quite literally sink no lower at all that God raises him upward. And it's a profound lesson on God's mercy and God's grace. It's the same thing that Paul says in Romans 5, right? While we were sinners, while we were weak, while we were ungodly, while we were enemies, Christ died for us. It's not because we were, you know, starting along the right path and he said, oh, they're trying so hard, I'll just nudge them along the last little bit. Or, well, they're just pretty good people. They have some, they're pretty good people, and so I'll help them get the last. No, what Paul says is that we were weak, ungodly, sinful enemies. That's when God reached out in his mercy to us. And the same thing is true of Jonah. It has nothing to do with Jonah and what he was or where he was or what he was thinking, and everything to do with God and God's gracious mercy. And when he is at his lowest, then God raises him upward. And he says, when my life was fading away, I remembered the Lord, and my prayer came to you into your holy temple. And so remembering, of course, as we've talked about before, is not merely intellectual recall. It is not that sort of memory, but it is action. It is always, when the Bible talks about remembering someone or remembering something, it is an action that is a result of that mental recall. He remembers the Lord. He calls out to the Lord. He makes vows to the Lord. All of that is what's wrapped up in this idea. He wants to be again a part of God's covenant community and do the things that he's supposed to do along these lines. And he appeals to a God that he knows is everywhere. This is what he said back in chapter 1. Pick me up and hurl me into the sea, because I know it is because of me that this tempest has come upon you. Even as he is trying to run away from God, he knows that he can't run away from God. He is fully aware that the storm is there because God sent the storm there. And he is fully aware that he is dying in the sea because God's waves and God's billows pass over him after God threw him into the sea. And so he knows that from his temple in Jerusalem, in verse 7, God can hear his prayer from the depths of the Mediterranean. Because this is a God who is everywhere. God is not limited to his temple. He is there in some sense, but he's not limited to that location. And so when Jonah calls out from the very depths of the earth, God will hear him even there. Yes, sir?
I've got a couple questions.
Sure. Yeah.
First of all, you were saying that the NIV translates it the same way every time?
Maybe not 100%, but it's pretty standard, if not 100%. They always translate it grave.
Okay, now, the ESV, that's a more literal translation.
Yeah.
Does that also do the same thing?
It doesn't translate it grave. It translates it Sheol most of the time.
Yeah,
well, it's actually not even a translation. It's a transliteration, technically.
Yeah, right.
I don't know if it does it 100% of the time, but I think most of the time it just gives you the Hebrew word in English letters.
The other question I have, just trying to learn about this word.
Sure.
Is it ever translated hell?
That I would have to look into to know offhand. I don't think so, but I'm not sure. I don't know what the standard Hebrew word for hell is.
Mostly just means a grave.
Yeah, a grave, realm of the dead, the idea of death, something like that. Yeah. It is equivalent, roughly, to the Greek word Hades,
okay,
which is not hell, but it, again, it's the idea of death in the realm
Hades
of the dead.
Is the waiting place.
Yeah, yes. And that's even its own interesting question. But like the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, typically will translate Sheol, Hades. And then in the New Testament, the word for hell is a different word altogether. It's Gehenna is the word for hell in the New Testament, which is a reference to the Valley of Hinnom, but that's too big of a discussion for right now.
Septuagint deserves a lot of respect because that's the translation that the apostles
Jesus had. That's right. And they quote from it as much or more than they quote from the Hebrew. So, yeah. You're going to say something, Stephen?
I was going to say something
about Gehenna. Okay. All right. Well, I'm not sure how we're running out of time so fast, but we are. So let's look at the last couple verses here as we move to verses 8 and 9. And this is an interesting thing, and I'm going to come back. I'm going to save some of this for our abbreviated third hour and make some more practical sorts of comments as we reflect on Jonah. For a moment, but it's an interesting, let's just say there's some interesting stuff here. As Jonah says in verses 8 and 9, those who pay regard to vain idols forsake their hope of steadfast love, but I, with a voice of thanksgiving, will sacrifice to you what I have vowed, I will pay. Salvation belongs to the Lord. So these idolaters who he's talking about, who forsake steadfast love is that word that we've talked about before that gets translated, the ESV translates it steadfast love, I think the New King James translates it mercy, the New American Standard translates it loving kindness, and you get a few other things as well here and there. And all of those ideas are good and right, and I don't know that one of them is a better translation than the other. This word is bigger than any one of those translations. It's all of those things and more. It is almost always in the Bible, when it's talked about God at least, suggesting a covenant context, that it is God's covenant mercy, that it is God's covenant loving kindness, God's covenant steadfastness. All of those ideas are wrapped up in the idea of God's promises that he has made to his people. And all of that is part of what this word is. And so idolaters forsake that. And the reason that that's interesting is here, all of a sudden, this guy who's sinking to the bottom of the ocean because he's been disobedient is saying bad things about idolaters. And this is probably the verse in Jonah that gets more negative reaction than just about anything. Who does this guy think he is, trashing idolaters when he's been acting like a pagan himself, thinking he can run away from God and disobeying God and all of those sorts of things? So what is going on here? Well, you know, it may well be that he's talking about himself. I've been acting like an idolater. That's who I'm talking about here. I'm not talking about the pagans on the ship or the pagans in Nineveh. I'm talking about me, because this is how I've been acting lately. And so there may be that. Some do see this as a contrast between himself as a worshiper of God and idolaters out in the world, in which case there may be a tinge of hypocrisy even here. I think one of my favorite things that I read as I was preparing for the class was someone who took that view and then suggested that maybe the fish vomited him out because it couldn't stomach the hypocrisy of Jonah, which I don't think is what's going on, but it was a funny thing to read. If this is intending to contrast himself with others, then it at least makes you raise an eyebrow and try to figure out what he's thinking. But another possibility is that this is the kind of thing that Psalms of Thanksgiving will have in them. So if Jonah is being informed by other psalms that he knows, or if he's singing a song that he knows, this may not have any specific, you know, intent of contrasting himself with anyone else, except perhaps that he is, you know, even upbraiding himself a little bit as he is praying. But whatever the case may be, and that's one of the things we'll come back and talk about in our third hour, is some idea of at least what to do with that as we think about ourselves. But that leads then to this vow, this promise that he makes to sacrifice to God. What I have vowed, I will pay, he says. And the idea of these vows, as they show up in other psalms, is not merely to worship in general, but to retake the psalmist, whoever he is in these psalms, to kind of retake his position as a responsible member of the covenant community who faithfully discharges his duties. I'm going to worship you, but I'm also going to be the person that I need to be in my life and discharge the duties that you've given me, is kind of a subtext of that. And that it becomes an appropriate vow for Jonah to make. Does Jonah fulfill this? Well, yes, in the sense that he does actually do what God tells him to do this next time. He does fulfill his obligations, but yeah, I think you could also say no. He doesn't really fulfill it in that his attitude is absolutely horrific even as he is obeying. And so there's that to consider as well. But that does seem to be the focal point. I have what I have vowed, I will pay, and he is immediately going to do what he is told to do the second time around. And the whole thing comes to a conclusion then with this phrase, salvation belongs to the Lord. And this is perhaps the key theme of the entire book of Jonah, is that God can save whom he wills to save. And here the idea that salvation belongs to the Lord thrills Jonah. And in chapter 4, the idea that salvation belongs to the Lord enrages Jonah. And salvation belongs to the Lord is very closely related to you, O Lord, have done as it pleased you, back in chapter 1 and verse 14, the idea of God's sovereignty in that context. And in both cases, God's sovereignty and God's saving will, however much Jonah acknowledges the truth of it, Jonah has a whole lot to learn about it. And these two ideas, God's sovereignty in 1:14 and God's salvific freedom here in 2:9 are the themes that Jonah has to wrestle with more than anything else when we get to chapter 4. And so I think it's helpful for us to realize these ideas are being presented to us at the beginning of the story so that when we see Jonah fighting against them later on, we've at least had some time to think about them up until that point. Well, I'll stop there. For now, I'm a little bit past time already. And so we'll stop there and pick back up with Jonah chapter 3 next time. As we've been considering Jonah in our class on Wednesdays and this morning, or this afternoon, I should say, as well. There's a great temptation always to just give Jonah a really hard time. And for good reason. I mean, here is a guy that God says, hey, Jonah, go do this. And he does the exact opposite of what it was that God tells him to do. And then you find him in the belly of the fish praying a prayer that, as we mentioned a little while ago, says negative things about idolaters. Even as he's been acting like one of them, and perhaps the idea that his prayer doesn't match his actions. He's speaking of great confidence in God, even though he's not been doing what God has told him to do. And then even as he goes on from there, he will obey God, at least he goes through the actions of doing what God tells him to do, and then promptly complains about things working out in the favor of the people that Jonah had been preaching against. And there's good reason that we look at him as a negative sort of character. I think we're supposed to look at him as a negative character in the story of Jonah. The story of Jonah is not about Jonah's heroism by any stretch of the imagination. He is the bad guy of his own story in a lot of ways. I mean, from chapter 1, when God says go and he flees, until chapter 4, where he's pouting about their salvation, and the last words are God chewing him out, he is the villain of his own story. But his story is not unlike so many others. And the reality is, his story is not unlike mine. And I dare not speak for you, but I'll let you weigh that in your own heart. And there is this tradition, of course, that treats Jonah's decision as foolish and sinful, and for good reason, because it is foolish and sinful. But we may do well to withhold our judgment at least a little bit, or at least perhaps to show a bit more compassion upon him, because his story is the story of so many other people. The story that begins when God says to Adam and Eve, "Do not eat," and they do eat. It continues, for example, when God says to Moses, "Go speak to someone." And Moses says, "I can't do that." God says, "Sure you can." He goes, "But who are they? Who am I going to tell them you are?" And he says, "Well, tell them I am sent you." "Well, who are they going to know who I am?" "Well, I can't." I mean, like five times he comes up with different excuses before he finally does it. And Jeremiah is called to go prophesy, and Jeremiah has excuses. The reality is Jonah's got a lot of companions, ancient and modern, foreign and domestic. And his response to a divine commission is not a unique response to a divine commission. It has been shared by so many people over the years. And that's not to say that it's good and that it's right, but that instead of looking at Jonah and impugning him as some sort of idiotic sinner, we should probably look at Jonah and say, is this a mirror of me that I'm looking into? And if it is, what do I need to do to change my behavior? Because the thing about Jonah is he really doesn't get much better as the story goes on. And he has that brief moment in chapter 2 where he utters this beautiful psalm. But for the most part, Jonah's not a whole lot better at the end than he is at the beginning. And that's why we need to look into the mirror of Jonah and see if that's our face that's looking back at us. And if it is, to change our behavior so that our story does not continue the way his story did. Jonah's companions were a whole lot safer when they threw him off the boat. Are our companions safer with us on it or with us off it? I think is a fair question that we should be asking ourselves on a regular basis. But then in chapter 2, he prays this prayer, like I said, that seems to, you know, make a mockery out of his words. He's not exulting in grand gratitude. He seems to be exulting in his own piety. I'm not like those who cling to worthless idols. And again, what exactly is he meaning in that line in chapter 2 is a tough thing to know for sure. But what is noteworthy is that if he is, at least for the sake of argument, exulting in his own piety and saying, you know, those who cling to worthless idols, they forsake their loving kindness. You know, thank God I'm not like them. If that is his attitude at all, I think it's noteworthy that the people on the boat and the citizens of Nineveh, all of them who are pagans, are living out loyalty to God far greater than Jonah is. They're living out the loyalty to God that Jonah's prayer is about and that it is admonishing, but that Jonah himself is not performing. But the reality also is that Jonah can't be treated one-sidedly when you look at him. He's not just a saint who appeals to God here in chapter 2 and a saint who goes and does what God tells him to do in chapter 3. And likewise, he's not just a sinner who runs away from God in chapter 1 and then pouts about God's forgiveness in chapter 4. Just like most people in the Bible and most people who've ever tried to live for God, sometimes Jonah's actions don't measure up to his words, and sometimes they do. When he sacrifices his life for the sailors, that's a pretty remarkable thing. When he calls out to God from the depths of Sheol, it's a pretty remarkable thing. When he goes and obeys God, even if he's doing so grudgingly, he's doing the right thing. Yet he's also the man who runs, and he's the man who pouts, and he's the man who hates. He is someone who is sometimes good and sometimes bad, and always a work in progress. That's who Jonah is. And the reason why that is so remarkable is because, again, when I look at Jonah, I see myself in that mirror. I'm probably more like him than I am different from him. Sometimes my actions and my words match up very well, and sometimes they don't. Sometimes I say what God would want me to say, and I do what God would want me to do. And sometimes I say what God would want me to say, and I don't do what God would want me to do. because I, like Jonah, am a work in progress. And again, what's terrifying about Jonah is that here is a man who knows all the right things to say. And on some level can say all of the right things. He says it in his prayer. He says it when he's preaching God's will in Nineveh. But he doesn't actually grow into that person over the course of his life. At least not over the course of this book. And so the book ends with God giving him a lecture on God's sovereign will and God's choice to save whom God would want to save. That is outside of Jonah's prerogative. And again, that is the question that faces me as I look at this, look at this book. Do I continue to grow? Am I trying to grow? Am I actually humbling myself before God? What am I doing so that day in and day out, my words and my actions match up more frequently than there is tension between them? Because that's the growth process. It's not that we are going to be perfect one day when we wake up. But we are growing more and more and more and more to be like God until in the end He perfects us when He makes us like Him. But these characters, like Jonah and so many others, are that call to remember, that call to consider our lives, that call to look at ourselves and say, where are we in this process? Not for us to stand in judgment over them, that we can so easily do, but to allow them to make us look at ourselves. And I think Jonah is a fantastic case of someone who needs to make us look at ourselves and say, am I saying bad things about him so I can avoid self-examination? Because I think we all continually need that self-examination. Well, that's all I really wanted to say for today. So we'll take the time to sing this song, Higher Ground, as we consider Jonah being lifted up from the bottom of the sea and spat out upon the land, that as God is lifting us up in His own way as well, as God is bringing us closer to being the people we should be, to rely on Him, to not rely on ourselves. And of course, if there's something that we can do today to help you out, you can let that be known as we stand and sing.